COVID-19 has forced colleges to switch to online classes, and that's forced teachers and students to adapt in a big hurry.
Everybody seems to be very flexible, have a common goal of how do we keep teaching and how do we keep learning.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how one university is making the switch and how Congress had to adjust the GI Bill. We'll also talk about medical education and spend an academic minute with political humor and gender. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The spread of the coronavirus has forced colleges and universities around the world to quickly put an end to normal campus life and move their classes from classrooms to the internet. This means professors who have never designed or taught an online course had to convert in mid-semester. To get an idea of what goes into that conversion, I spoke to Dr. Michelle Horton, an assistant vice president at the University of West Florida and leader of the Center for Global Online Learning and Development at the school. We started by first talking about online or distance learning and how long that's been a thing.
Well, it's been a thing for decades now. More than 20 years at the University of West Florida, we have been teaching online courses, and we have a large number of fully online programs.
Did it start off as an economic thing, or did it just seem like this was the good way to teach certain subjects?
Well, it really started off for an opportunity to provide more flexibility for people who wanted to continue their education. So we have a lot of people returning to college who are working and raising their families, and they need different ways to continue their education, and online learning serves that purpose.
And have your students who have graduated found that this is becoming an accepted thing? Like, yes, you got a degree. I don't care how you got it.
It's absolutely an accepted thing, and it's growing. It's continuing to grow as more and more people are realizing that their continued work pathways will require more education. So people are returning to online learning as a way to continue their career path.
How are in-classroom teachers adapting and in-classroom students adapting to this?
Well, I've been amazed at the way that our faculty and our students have come together to figure this out, and we're all figuring it out together. It's been a very large community of supporters. The team that I lead at the Global Online Learning and Development Center, they are a small but mighty team of instructional designers, and I've really been impressed at their ability to customize the training as we shift from face-to-face instruction to remote instruction. It's very different from preparing for a fully online class.
I'm sure the curriculum itself, the actual nuts and bolts of what you have to teach is the same, but doing it has got to be way different.
It is very different. And we knew going into this that we had to develop some customized training for helping to meet faculty where they were in regards to their experience with the utilization of technology, their experience with teaching remotely. And so we knew that we could not throw everything out as far as resources and technology at one time. We broke down our instruction or our training and support into three different categories. We wanted instructors to know, how are you going to communicate? How are you going to teach or distribute your instruction? And how are you going to assess students and their learning, their grades, their exams? So we really kept our support in the development of, say, how-to videos to those three categories. What technology fit into communication like web conferencing or teaching like recording your videos in Panopto or YouTube and doing a flipped classroom style approach where students can look at the video first and then you can have a web conference to discuss what they were learning that particular week. And then how are you going to assess? We have a lot of faculty that have really embraced this technology and students are creating videos and they're submitting presentations as if they were in their classroom giving their presentation.
Is it still on a schedule? Do you have biology Tuesdays at 10 o'clock?
It's really flexible right now. So that is the preferred method for many instructors. So they're saying we're going to still meet every day or Mondays and Wednesdays at 10 a.m. for a live biology lecture and instruction. But some of them are taking that flipped classroom model and saying, here's my recorded instruction for the week. Here's my PowerPoint with my voiceover on top of it. Let's talk about it on Wednesday at noon during our normal class time. So it's really been interesting to navigate using technology in a different way. But it's also been great because we have some amazing faculty, obviously some very great students and staff to support everybody.
Keeping the students engaged must be because, they're home right
yes.
now and keeping them on their schedule, keeping them engaged in their education, that's got to be a challenge.
It is a challenge. It is a challenge because students have had to leave oftentimes their dorms and go back home. And things are very different at home from when they left it. They may have siblings at home that are also in the K-12 system taking classes online. They may have parents at home that are working remotely. So it's a very different environment for their learning. But I have been very proud of the fact that our instructors have intentionally understood what everyone is facing. And altogether, this university as a whole is reaching out to students and saying, how can we help you? How can we make this easier for you? And everybody seems to be very flexible, have a common goal of how do we keep teaching and how do we keep learning?
Other than the actual instruction, this is not the college experience these people were hoping they were going to get.
That's true. But the unique situation is that everyone in the world right now is facing this unprecedented time and this uncharted waters. So it's not any one institution or organization that's going through this. We're all going through it together. And it has a really big impact. But I think if we can focus on any type of normalcy, any type of completion, I think it will really help us all to be able to accomplish the goals that we originally set up as we approach this first semester of we need to finish. We need to finish strong. And how can we best do that?
When you're designing a class for online, there's a little more nuts and bolts at that. How much of it is live instruction? How much is it pre-recorded lessons?
It really depends. And again, we're talking about remote instruction right now, and it's very different from how we prepare for a fully online class that starts online and finishes online during the same semester. So today we're just focusing on continuing the teaching and learning piece because we had to switch in the middle of a semester from face-to-face instruction to virtual or remote instruction. And so when we're preparing for online courses, we're preparing for an entire semester from start to finish, modules, weeks, and there might be a combination of live class sessions, but a lot of recorded short instructional videos that have different ways of assessment during the online instruction period. Right now, we need to finish the semester, and we need to make sure that our students know how to reach us and communicate. And we need to make sure our faculty know how to distribute their instruction. And we also need to make sure that students are getting the opportunity to truly assess what they're learning in different ways than what we planned in the beginning of this semester. And that is happening. We're providing the support for faculty. We started several weeks ago by dusting off our continuity plan that was really designed for hurricane preparedness, but we modified it to continuity of instruction. And we developed recorded videos to help faculty understand what the technology is available for communicating, teaching, and assessing remotely. We set up boot camps. So up until last week, faculty could come see us in our IT building and we could work with them on a computer. But all the while, we've had a WebEx link available. It's Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Faculty can pop in, meet with an instructional designer and say, I'm having this specific problem. Because we know that everybody's at a different level. Everybody has a different comfort level with technology. Everybody has a different experience of using technology to teach. I've also been impressed with our faculty who do have the expertise in teaching online. They have been very supportive of their peers and offering different types of support from their academic discipline to other instructors who may need it.
Was there enough infrastructure in place to take a whole lot more online students than you were really planning on?
There is, because we've been doing online learning for quite some time. So we have a learning management system. We utilize the LMS called Canvas. And we were prepared to turn on online classes for every course that we offer. We have a course template for every single course, whether it's taught face-to-face or online. And so we were able to quickly turn on all of those courses and build upon our existing online infrastructure with little problems.
Were you able to make sure that the students had the technology to participate in this?
That has been something that we're continuing to work on. There are students that don't have the equipment to work from home, and we're being very mindful of that. Our library has set up a checkout system for utilization of laptops while you're at home. We're continuing to work with students to get them the equipment they need for home. But we're also very flexible and understanding if you don't have the equipment, let's figure out a way to continue.
Is the university planning on, well, we're probably going to be doing this in the summer too?
Absolutely. We just announced this week that our courses offered this summer will be fully online. And so students will have the opportunity to continue their education. We want them to continue. Many of them are approaching graduation. We don't want them to have to pause. And so the ability to quickly onboard more online courses is really critical to a lot of our students.
And I know it's too early to start thinking about this, but is there a plan being made to carry this on into the next fall semester?
It's too soon to say. But if that is the case, we're certainly prepared for that. But I do believe it's absolutely too soon to say. As you know, things are changing day by day.
Aren't you glad you don't have to make up an online curriculum for kindergarten?
Yes, I am glad. That would be a particular challenge. And, you know, and that's what I see that a lot of faculty, staff, students, we're all in the same boat. We're all having to address different issues that are not ideal for teaching and learning, but we're getting through it together.
Dr. Michelle Horton is an assistant vice president at the University of West Florida and leads the university's Center for Global Online Learning and Development. Congress has passed urgent legislation to ensure military veterans can continue to attend college. Hundreds of thousands of veterans get federal tuition and housing benefits through the post-9/11 GI Bill, but many received word they could lose those benefits if their colleges move to online instruction because of the COVID-19 pandemic. For the American Homefront Project, Jennifer Brookland reports.
Christine Peterson spent 5 years in the Marine Corps and used the GI Bill to get her undergraduate degree at Georgetown University. Now she's a master's student there. She also served as a chapter president for Student Veterans of America. That's how she learned the Department of Veterans Affairs would stop paying some GI Bill benefits for students whose in-person classes transitioned to online.
I first received an email from the VA. The email itself was incredibly ambiguous to me, and I'm someone that has worked in veterans higher education advocacy for 3 to 4 years now.
The VA notice said students can keep receiving benefits only if their school's state approving agency had authorized it to offer online instruction. It's not clear how many programs or institutions that affects. The VA didn't provide a list. But all kinds of colleges and universities around the country have switched from traditional classes to online classes in the past few weeks because of the pandemic. Peterson says the notice from the VA is explicit that keeping tuition and housing allowances unchanged required congressional action.
They're essentially telling student veterans, like, help is on the way, but we can't advocate for or against this help because it's a legislative fix. So I found that really interesting. They are definitely straddling a line here.
In the wake of the VA announcement, the Congress did rapidly pass a bill to allow student veterans to continue receiving their normal allowances, even if their programs remain in distance learning mode. The bipartisan bill moved through the Senate and House with no opposition. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Robert Wilkie had assured student veterans their benefits would not actually be taken away.
They're not going to lose them. No, they're not losing them. They'll still get their benefits.
Lauren Augustine advocated in Washington to make sure the bill passed. She's the Vice President of Government Affairs for Student Veterans of America. She says lawmakers were interested in finding a solution and fast, but with the pandemic, it was all new territory.
These are completely uncharted waters. I don't think that there's ever been a time where we've seen sort of mass movement of universities from in-person classes and business as normal to, you know, upside down world and classes online and canceled and moving out of the dorms with no notice. And for student veterans, this is a really unique issue. And the Hill's paying attention and the VA's paying attention.
Augustine says an immediate fix was needed because a lot of student veterans rely on those GI benefits, not just to pay tuition, but to live and support their families. Christine Peterson says she has some savings, but was worried they wouldn't be enough if her GI Bill payments were halted next term, and she worried about student veterans who support older parents or children.
If my benefits are impacted, we don't have any income coming into our home, and so it's not quite at the scared point yet because we have savings. But I mean, I know for a fact, like, the fact that we have savings already puts us in a very different situation than a lot of my peers. And we also don't have children. So our concerns are honestly quite small compared to a lot of my peers.
Peterson says she knows other populations will be disproportionately affected by this pandemic. She says she feels lucky as a student veteran to be in one group that garners bipartisan support. I'm Jennifer Brooklyn reporting.
Still to come, fighting any disease begins with medical training. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. While taking a tour of Stanford University a while back, I had a chance to talk with Dr. Lloyd Minor, the Dean of the School of Medicine at Stanford. With so much attention on doctors and researchers right now, we thought it would be interesting to hear again how medical training begins and how it's changed over the years. I asked Dr. Minor if his younger self would recognize medical training today.
Some of the core disciplines have remained relatively the same. So anatomy is still anatomy, although now we're able to link the study and teaching of anatomy to radiology and other imaging modalities in ways that certainly was not done when I was in medical school. I think the big change in medical education since I was in medical school is now much more emphasis on learning how to learn. Today in medical education, we're preparing physicians for a lifelong learning experience. You know, memorizing the dose of drugs, as we used to do when I was coming through medical school, it's not advisable, and it's also not necessary. It's not necessary because it can readily be available in electronic medical record to calculate the dose based upon the patient's weight and other parameters. It's not advisable because human memory just isn't that accurate, even under the best of circumstances. A lot of that emphasis on rote memorization has diminished, probably needs to diminish even more in the future. But what we're trying to do today is to prepare students, prepare physicians for lifelong learning, and to give them the tools that they can use throughout their professional careers to continue their journey of learning.
It's interesting you mentioned anatomy. The other day I was touring your cadaver lab, and some of the 3D imaging there is amazing.
It is amazing what we can do with simulations and with simulation of the way tissue appears, the way tissue planes are organized in the body, and then wed that directly with a radiographic image or an MRI image. So a student then gets the perspective of how he or she will be examining this particular region of the body through the studies that will be ordered, and then how it really looks like underneath the surface of the skin, which many physicians will never be seeing the organ or the structure beyond an imaging modality unless they go into a particular surgical field.
A team-based education model seems to be what you were talking about earlier. Talk about that. How is a physician now being trained to be a member of a team?
I think it begins with the very first days of medical school, when we emphasize that learning should take place in teams, when we do simulations. You know, the days of see one, do one, teach one in medical education are thankfully over, and we simulate and train in an out-of-clinic environment for all the key clinical skills and procedures. And this type of education is done entirely in teams and learning in teams. It's resetting the mindset about what a physician is. A physician is a valued member of a team, not an omniscient, omnipotent provider of health care.
And earlier you mentioned as the family actually becoming a member of that team. How are physicians being taught to incorporate the family and maybe even communicate with the family?
I think it comes from the first clinical experiences of interviewing patients and then interviewing family members with patients to understand the impact of disease on the family environment as well as on the individual patient. I think it comes from encouraging students also to talk about their own experiences in their families in the healthcare delivery environment. Most people have had an experience with the healthcare delivery system. What was that like? How did that impact their thinking about the way they would have liked it to have been if it wasn't desirable? And then bringing that into their experience and their insight when they develop and hone their skills of empathy. I think empathy is an extraordinarily important attribute for every physician to have, and empathy derives from being able to put yourself in the shoes of another person to really try to understand what they're feeling and what they're experiencing, and then gauging your actions and your interactions accordingly.
Something we've talked about on the program before is the concept of the flipped classroom, and it seems it's something that's really being done at Stanford. Tell us how that's done.
It's done in a variety of different ways. The basis for the flipped classroom is the observation that each of us learns differently. Some of us actually learn a lot in a lecture environment if we're auditory learners. Others don't derive any or very little benefit at all from a lecture. The idea is that if we as a field define what a base of knowledge and sort of intellectual skill set is for a discipline, then we should be able to present that base of knowledge and skill set in a variety of different ways so that students can come up to speed and acquire the necessary skills and knowledge through a variety of different approaches. And finally, it recognizes that sitting in a lecture and taking notes is the most extreme form of a passive learning experience. Problem solving, discussing clinical vignettes, those are all inherently more interactive and are much more likely to lead to lasting learning than simply the type of rote activities that can occur in a lecture environment.
Talk a little bit about the attempts to bring down student debt.
Scholarships are an important component, and one of the things that we try to do is to maintain a base of endowment that provides income that can be used for scholarships for students based upon need. The other components are activities related to MD-PhD programs, for example, that oftentimes the educational experience is covered by the grant that provides the training in the program. The notion is to try to give students the opportunity to pursue their passion intellectually in terms of the field they choose, the course of study they choose, and to empower them to do that without incurring an overly burdensome degree of debt.
You spoke about possibly changing the length of time it takes to get a medical degree at the school. Does that go both ways? You can also take more time if you think you need more study or you want to study something different?
Yes, it does. So about 60% of our students take more than 4 years before they get their MD degree. That's because they choose to pursue a scholarly concentration and maybe focus an entire year in a research lab, or they choose to get a degree from another degree-awarding program at the university, like in law or in business. But affording that flexibility is the way that we believe we can encourage development of leaders in medicine in the future.
Dr. Lloyd Miner is the Dean of the School of Medicine at Stanford University. People just love making fun of politicians, but when the target of that barb is a woman, do the jokesters have to step a little gingerly? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Does political humor look the same way when aimed at female candidates? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Heather Yates, assistant professor of political science at the University of Central Arkansas, delves into this question.
The intersection of humor and politics in America is a time-honored tradition, and in the modern era is a common fixture in popular entertainment. Humor can be used to inoculate audiences against a difficult truth or an awkward moment. When it's aimed at public figures, jokes are used to exploit weaknesses and amplify human flaws. In the U.S., politics has been long defined by masculine norms. Jokes aimed at women politicians may yield different effects than when aimed at men. Rarely are men viewed negatively after being subjected to a political joke. But what happens when marginalized groups begin to break into politics? Since women have a shorter established tenure in politics, are the jokes aimed at them more harmful? Studying popular entertainment offers some insights. A content analysis of the popular HBO series Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Selina Meyer, the nation's first woman vice president and later president, illustrates what effects political humor might have on an audience's views of women politicians. First, jokes aimed at women politicians commonly portray her as a fish out of water. For the joke to have an effect, it labors under the assumption that public office is a masculine space where women must undergo a masculine transformation in order to fit in and succeed. Second, humor commonly relies on sexist content for its desired effect, reinforcing what sociologist Susan Douglas calls enlightened sexism, when overt sexism and gendered prejudices are rendered invisible by a joke intended to mock feminism and convey its lack of utility in modern society. Third, the playful ridicule of women politicians can quickly turn from politics as play to play as punishment for women. Jokes satirizing women in politics risks conveying to audiences that the only way a woman is taken seriously in politics is by internalizing the traditional masculine norms of the office.
That was Heather Yates of the University of Central Arkansas. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.